Daily news and analysis. We keep you informed and inspired.
This is World Today.
Hello and welcome to World Today. I'm Zhao Ying. Coming up, Chinese President Xi Jinping has met with the chairman of Vietnam's National Assembly. How does cooperation between China and Vietnam benefit both sides? U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen reiterates that Washington doesn't seek to decouple from China. We bring you more on Yellen's trip to China and her engagement with Chinese officials. And Israel has significantly reduced the number of troops in Gaza. What could happen next? Chinese President Xi Jinping has called for strengthening mutual trust and promoting high-quality cooperation with Vietnam. He made the remarks when meeting with National Assembly Chairman Wang Dinghui in Beijing. Xi Jinping says defending the socialist system and maintaining national stability and development are the common interests of the two nations. He said they should work together for a China-Vietnam community with a shared future. Chairman Wang Dinghui said China is a strategic priority. He said Vietnam's National Assembly is willing to maintain close exchanges with China's National People's Congress and play a positive role in consolidating the friendship between the two sides. For more, we are joined by Yang Xiyu, Research Fellow at China Institute of International Studies. What do you make of the timing and significance of the meeting between Chinese President Xi Jinping and Chairman of the National Assembly of Vietnam, Wang Dinghui?
I think this latest meeting between Chinese and Vietnamese leaders is a further step deepening strategic relations between the two countries. As we know, last year, Chinese President Xi Jinping visited Vietnam, and the two sides upgrade the bilateral relation in the highest level called community with the shared future at a strategic level. And since then, every area in the bilateral relation has been moved faster towards the deepened and more closely tied bilateral relation, ranging from the political, economic, social, people-to-people, and strategic level. This latest high-level officials from Vietnam visited Beijing. Technically, is a return visiting for the high-level exchanges between the two countries. And at the policy level, I think this is very important for further cooperation, especially between legislations between the two sides, besides the legislation bodies, exchanges, and the high-level meetings also touch on the many other detailed areas. I think through this meeting and visit, the two countries' cooperation will go further for the mutual benefited direction.
Yes, you mentioned this announcement of building a China-Vietnam community with a shared future during President Xi's visit to the country at the end of last year. Can you elaborate on the significance of this announcement and how can this concept of shared future translate into concrete actions?
Let me put it a bit by this way. In the future, I think the whole world will sooner or later move towards the same direction. Although now we are facing so many challenges with varied contradictions and complicated issues between countries. In nature, in general, all countries, all peoples has only one shared future. You cannot divide the earth. That is strategic thinking was elaborated by President Xi Jinping as the shared future for the whole mankind. But because of the reality, because of the existing differences and the challenges facing various countries, it's a long way for all countries to go together. However, between Chinese and Vietnam, the two countries explore the new path between the two countries for the cooperation towards the shared future. I think this concept and plan for the cooperation towards the shared future, not only significant for both of the countries, China and Vietnam, but also the cooperation and the exploration of the new path will set up a model for the other countries towards the shared future direction for the better cooperation between various countries. So in short, the progresses on China-Vietnam bilateral relations toward the shared future will not only benefit for the two countries, but also will have a very important meaning and influences on the other countries.
Yeah, and Xi Jinping emphasized the concept of comrades plus brothers to describe the traditional friendship between China and Vietnam. How does that reflect the historical and cultural ties between the two countries?
The very special term you mentioned, say, comrades plus brothers, reflects quite a unique nature of Chinese-Vietnamese relations. The frame was made several decades ago, during which both China and Vietnam faced challenges from the United States. And also, the two countries made a very close cooperation hand-in-hand for fight against Americans' invasion on Vietnam. Since then, we set a very solid base for the bilateral relation between two countries. In other words, the phrase of comrades plus brothers, on one hand, reflects the very unique traditions between the two countries' bilateral relation, but also reflects the significance in the nowadays. So we called the comrades and the plus brothers contains the meaning of the tradition and also contains the future for the bilateral relation. Just because of the reason and the two countries, the cooperation today based on the tradition, but explore a new way for the future. That is the new meaning of the comrades plus brother for the bilateral relation today.
Okay, and President Xi also expressed China's willingness to enhance exchanges in governing both the party and the country. Can you elaborate on what specific areas of expertise each country might share with the other, and what potential benefits might such exchanges bring to both sides?
Xi Jinping mentioned this meeting because China and Vietnam share the similar challenges and the similar opportunities for the better future of both of the countries. As everyone knows, China and Vietnam share the similar political not only based on the tradition, but also based on the today's reality and the challenges and opportunities. Facing the similar changes and based on the similar past and today's tasks, governing of the country, also governing the party, means the China-Vietnam bilateral relation and the bilateral cooperation will not only touch on many common areas like many other bilateral relations, but also the China-Vietnam bilateral relation cooperation will touch on the very unique area, say the party's governance and the country's governance, and also we will explore jointly for the better future of both of the countries.
Okay, and President Xi also mentioned the Belt and Road Initiative and Vietnam's two corridors and one economic circle strategy. We know both initiatives aim to boost regional connectivity and economic development. So how can they be better aligned to maximize benefits for both China and Vietnam, as well as the wider Southeast Asian region?
Both China and Vietnam have strong influences on Southeast Asia. And also, China and Vietnam, as developing countries, face the similar changes and attacks for the modernization of both of the countries. Therefore, the two sides have set up a very detailed economic cooperation for further better connectivities between the two countries under the plan, as you mentioned, the two corridors and one economic circle. This plan will not only make a closer ties between the two economies, but also will contribute to the integration in this region, say, Southeast Asia and China, and also the success of two corridors and the one economic cycle will set up a model for, in general, for the many other areas cooperation under the One Belt, One Road initiatives. One Belt, One Road is a comprehensive plan that is composed by many detailed and special plans, such as two cradles and one economic circles in this region. So I think in Southeast Asia, the success of the two cradles and one economic circle will present experiences and also provide momentum for many other detailed cooperation plans under the One Belt, One Road initiative.
Well, President Xi also stressed the importance of youth and sister city exchanges. Why are these exchanges seen as crucial for the future of bilateral ties?
Simply because the very solid base for the better relation between China and Vietnam come from people-to-people exchanges. People-to-people exchanges is a comprehensive area. Among them, I think sister city exchanges programs will play a very key role for the people-to-people exchanges, simply because the city exchanges will cover wide range of programs ranging from the culture, education, health, climate, not mentioned to economic and political exchanges at a local level. So with the stringent programs of sister city exchanges, I think at the level of the whole bilateral relation, people-to-people exchanges will be enhanced and promoted for the whole bilateral relation.
Well, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi met with his Vietnamese counterpart in Guangxi last week. During that meeting, he expressed both sides should be wary of creating camp confrontation in the region. How do you interpret this statement in the context of regional dynamics?
Well, I think, needless to say, there are many common interests in China and Vietnam, but also there are also complicated differences between two countries, just like many other bilateral relations in the world. And I think what Wang Yi mentioned actually pointed out the correct way for dealing with China-Vietnam relations. On one hand, we will make further efforts to enhance the cooperation in the shared interest area. But meanwhile, the two countries will make joint efforts to deal with sophisticated, complicated issues where the two countries indeed have some differences. I think the joint efforts will certainly further stabilize the bilateral relation and will certainly make the bilateral relation more matured. And such experiences contains not only bilateral meeting but also regional meeting, simply because in these regions there are a lot of common shared interests. Meanwhile, there have been quite many sophisticated, sensitive differences. So China and Vietnam will explore successful experiences to deal with the sophisticated differences.
That's Yang Xiyu, Research Fellow with China Institute of International Studies. You're listening to World Today. Stay with us. You're listening to World Today. I'm Zhao Ying. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has reiterated that Washington doesn't seek to decouple from China. Towards the end of her visit to China, Yellen said decoupling would bring catastrophic consequences given the close economic ties between the two countries. Yellen met with Chinese Premier Li Qiang on Sunday, who called on the U.S. to abide by the basic norms of market economy, including fair competition and open cooperation, and refrain from turning economic and trade issues into political or security issues. Premier Li urged the U.S. to view the issue of production capacity objectively from a market-oriented and global perspective. Yellen has also met other Chinese officials during her six-day trip, including Chinese Vice Premier He Lifeng, Central Bank Governor Peng Gongshun, and the Mayor of Beijing, Ying Yong. For more, we are joined by Professor Qu Qiang, Fellow of Belt and Road Research Center at Minzu University of China. Professor Qu, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So what do you think are the primary goals of Yellen's visit to China, and what are your biggest takeaways from her engagements with Chinese officials?
Well, I think the primary goal of Yellen's visit to China, I think there are several. I think number one is, well, everybody probably has read it from their public manifesto after the visit, that is the contact with their Chinese counterparts, to make more of the coordination of the bilateral trade relations, economic arrangement, as well as the financial, contact. So I think that this information has already been very well, passed on to Chinese side. But I also think there is a other goal of her visit to China is that to ease the tension and to avoid misreading about, both respective, intentions, as well as, to pass on this information to the Chinese counterparts. And I think Yellen's visit is also very well, passed on this message, because if you can read all these details, beyond all those, public manifesto, you will see Yellen has been smiling, all the way along, visiting the forbidden cities and also ask for the Cantonese food as well as for the strong food. And also you can read between the thin air that the atmosphere of this, conversation and meeting are really very well. So I think this is also a very important gesture and information that we can feel that, the Chinese and American counterparts, especially in the financial and economic work, they try to make the things work because they understand the coordination between the two most important economies in the whole world is very important in the coming days. So I think this is probably the other hidden agenda between this, during this visit.
Yes, and Janet Yellen emphasized in the press conference that the U.S. does not seek to decouple from China. How do you think we should interpret this statement?
Well, I think this is just what it shows, on the words itself. So you can just read the words literally. I think Janet Yellen is probably one of the most renowned economists and a financial researcher in the whole world. And I think if anyone could understand the importance of Chinese and American financial and economic cooperation, and she will definitely be one of them. So Janet Yellen made it very clear that United States has no intention to decouple with China. She even didn't try to, come up with or to revise of her words, like, we're not going to decouple with China. We just try to de-risk in some area. She didn't even, come up with that kind of, supplementary wordings. So it shows that she means that we still need to work with each other. America, if you take a look at the numbers, inflation is not that easy to go away. We see very stubborn, situation in this area. So people are still, very, very worried about how they can or how long they can continue with their interest rate policy, when they're going to, cut the interest rate lower, as we expected. So I think right now is more important than, ever that we work with each other. So I think that's what Yellen means.
Yes, but one of the key topics being discussed during Yellen's visit is what she describes as China's industrial overcapacity. What do you make of the U.S. concerns in this regard?
Well, a lot of people are saying, okay, see, here is another difference. There's another excuse for the further quarrel or, conflicts. Well, actually, from my view, that Yellen's words actually cope with Chinese policymakers to a very large extent. You see, Chinese policymakers are always one of the most important forces to try to avoid overcapacity in the past 20 years. Do you remember that back in 2014 and 2015 that we still actually have a campaign called the supply side reform to cut overcapacity in the traditional sectors. And now we have this, new sectors, new advancement in many other sectors in our economy, for example, like solar panel, like EV. Even though we are cheering for our achievement, what we have already done in this area very, very well, but also Chinese policymakers is also more than anyone else, very alert about, are we going to have overcapacity in this area? Are we going to have more of the involution of inside of our own? So in the past 3 or 4 years, the Chinese government works very well, try to, get rid of the subsidies or support redundant support in this area to avoid a situation happening again in this new area rather than like this happened in the old area. So I think Yellen also means a similar situation. I think Chinese policymaker has already been very well aware of. So if it's not Yellen saying the same thing, if it's just a domestic Chinese scholar saying the things, hey, we better, you know, be very, very alert about overcapacity in this new area, probably, you know, the Chinese, you know, audience will feel, you know, just, he's right. He's probably the normal thing we need to, you know, look into that.
Okay, but we also hear Premier Li Qiang saying that the U.S. should view the issue of production capacity objectively and from a market-oriented and global perspective. What does he mean by that?
Well, I think both of them are correct. I think Premier Li Qiang has a very strong argument in here because for now, the EV, solar panel, and the lithium battery is actually not in overcapacity situation. Actually, viewing from the global situation, now global-wise, this is not even, you know, oversupply. It's actually in the shortage of supply. Many countries try to build their own EV capacity, solar panel capacity, and have their own lithium battery. China are actually making the contribution to help the whole world to have this new round of industrial revolution, and also to help the whole world to achieve the zero emission, you know, environmental protection target. So for the short term, yes, indeed, we are helping the world with our capacity. But I mean, in the long run, so can we just make this going on in a more sustainable way, in a more, you know, healthier way? I think to be a very large extent, it depends on our decision making and how the Chinese industry in this regard to react and respond in the long run. So I think in the long run, yes, they're probably going to be, you know, a possibility of overcapacity. But for now, it's not. So I think strike the balance between the short term and long term vision is very important. So I think both of them are correct.
Yeah, and also the Chinese premier highlighted China's commitment to the development of its new energy industry and its contribution to global green and low carbon transition. What do you make of the prospect of cooperation between China and the U.S. in this field?
Well, I think most important is that we need to understand, first of all, this is very important for China to develop this new area, this new products like solar panel, lithium battery, you know, green product and green industry. This is not only good for economy, but also good for our, you know, both agreed, you know, climate change issued. So only when China and the U.S., this two largest economy, can work with each other on this front, and then as all human society and all as human being as a whole, that we can win this battle against the climate change. So I think this must be understood. So right now it's very important just to give out this traditional thinking pattern, that is to demonize each other, you know, put down the dirty comment on each other, you know, on your capacity, on your price, on the trade, but focus on how we can work together to make the technology more available, to make the products more available. And then we can tackle our common challenges in a climate change as one. So this is very important. So put away those ideological, you know, narratives away, and, you know, form a new narrative that combines all human beings together, and use this narrative and to coordinate our, you know, technology cooperation, our economic and trade cooperation. This uttermost important thing.
Yeah, thank you, Professor Qi Qiang, Research Fellow of Belt and Road Research Center at Minzu University of China. Coming up, Israel has significantly reduced the number of troops in Gaza. What could happen next? And Mexico has cut diplomatic ties with Ecuador after Ecuadorian police stormed the Mexican embassy to arrest former Ecuadorian vice president. So what happened there? And for further discussion, you can follow us on Next at CGTN Radio. You're listening to World Today. We'll be back after a short break. You're listening to World Today. I'm Zhao Ying. Official data shows 119 million domestic tourist trips were made in China during the three-day Qingming Festival holiday. This total is up 11% from the same period in 2019. Domestic tourism revenue was nearly 54 billion yuan, or about 7.6 billion US dollars. Meanwhile, in March, China's manufacturing sector experienced its most rapid expansion in over a year. So what do all these figures say about China's economy so far this year? For more, my colleague Zhao Yang spoke with senior research fellow Zhou Mi with the Chinese Academy of International Trade and Economic Cooperation.
So, Dr. Zhou, we've seen a significant surge in travel and consumption during the holiday. What are the popular models of travel during this holiday, and where are among the most popular destinations?
Yeah, we know that these holidays just have, we have only 3 days. So many of people choose to go some nearby places. So they can use the high-speed rail to go to the place, or they can drive their own car. So personally, I went to Xiong'an. It's a very important city and not far from Beijing. So I went there just in 2 or more hours. So we spent some time to enjoy the life there. Many people are trying to discover some new things around the cities. I think that most of these people are coming from the main cities of China, like Beijing, Guangdong, and Shanghai. So they are really trying to spread some of their time and enjoy very good time in the near cities or places.
Mm. And what are your perception of the state of China's economy right now? What about, for example, the foreign trade so far this year? Will the new three of China's exports, namely the solar panel, EVs, and batteries, continue to grow for the rest of the year?
Yeah, when we're talking about the economy, I would say that the start of this year is a pretty good one compared with last year, or even compared with the latter of last year. We see the data of the trade, of the investment, and also, about the manufacturing capacities. They are recovering very quickly. So, I mean, that is, a reflection about the world economy's recovery. They have recovered from the COVID quite a lot. And by the way, you're talking about the new three things, and these are some innovative products that China's quite capable of in producing last year and the year before last. We know that the world is really needing these kind of new things to adapt to the requirement of the climate change and trying to improve their abilities for more climate sustainable development. So, I mean, that is a huge demand. We still see so many countries are struggling to reach that kind of degree. But from other side, we know that for any kind of products, they have the product life cycle. That means that one technology will spread from one country to other country gradually by imitation, by kind of other competition. So many Chinese companies are also investing in other countries for the EV companies. I mean, that will definitely strengthen the abilities and of the supply chains and trying to encourage the local market in other countries. So in this regard, I think that we have a very good potential for development. As you may find that China's the commerce minister went to Europe to try to discuss about the intergovernment cooperation or about the environment. So I think that the involvement of the government, especially trying to improve the environment, is very important for a sustainable development of these industries, of the new energy industry.
Mm. And Dr. Zhou, you mentioned innovation, technology, the new quality productive forces has been emphasized for the China's economy. So how critical is that, and what effects might this strategy have on China's economic performance?
Yeah, we can understand this concept from two sides. For China, we need to improve the ability of using the resources more wisely, or with a higher technology. We can try to provide better services and products to Chinese consumers, also the countries who want to buy our products. Well, for the from another angle, if you are looking at the world, you may find that so many countries are trying to move on the global value chains. It means that many of the China manufacturing and sectors are under competitions with so many other countries. We don't want to crush the space of development of other countries. So we choose to find an alternative way of development, that is new productive ways of development. So actually it's a kind of cooperation, not only trying to use the pool of the world market just by us. We want to cooperate with our partners to develop that with a better performance.
So how do you see the current transformation of China's economy? And also, how do you see that is influencing the foreign investor sentiment and portfolio here in China?
Yeah, first, the Chinese government sent a very clear signal that China wants this higher quality development. So we are creating better policies, better opening up, you know, environment and a better support for the innovative ways of development by the human resources, by the infrastructure. That is definitely a very good environment for the FDI to come here to invest. And second, I think that the market of China is very potential. Then many Chinese consumers want to experience new things. So they like to experience this, and these are providing a very good, you know, initial market for this product to development. And the third one, we have a very good base, and I mean, cooperation among the sectors, among the industries are real important for the transfer from the traditional one to a new one.
And China's Ministry of Commerce has reported that over 70,000 U.S. companies have invested and established businesses in China as of January this year. And according to a recent report by the American Chamber of Commerce in China, 50% of the surveyed U.S. companies consider China as their first or top three investment destination. So what do all this tell us?
Yeah, I mean, they tell us a truth that the world, I mean, the market is real functioning, and the investor real believe the Chinese market are their good choices. So no matter where they come from the developed economies or from the developing countries, they want to explore their own style of development in China, and that will provide them with a longer term of return and a more sustainable way of a cooperation with, you know, in such an uncertain world in this time.
And the U.S. Secretary of Treasury, Janet Yellen, is now visiting China. Despite the differences, despite what can actually be achieved by Secretary Yellen's visit to China, the fact that the world's two largest economies, at least, are talking at high levels is a positive sign. So what does it mean for the world's two largest economy and also the global economy, do you think?
Yeah, I agree with you that, you know, when the two very big economies are trying to crush each other, it is very dangerous for other economies in the world. So for the both China and the United States, if we are able to find some ways to deal with the disputes, to try to find some consensus, it is really helpful. I mean, that not only by the very changeable agreement. If we can keep in touch, it is a very good signal for, you know, to be observed by the market. Actually, from Secretary Yellen, from her opinions and addressings, we know that she is also trying to send a message to the U.S. companies. You cannot be left behind. You should try to work hard in China's market because so many other countries are working here. If they are, you know, have to hesitate about the decisions, it will be too late for them to catch up in the future. So actually, both sides are really want to, you know, make the better use of our resources and to trying to have a better support of the economy. And that is not workable if we are trying to fight against each other.
And some Western observers said China's long period of rapid growth has peaked. And some people claim that China's overcapacity is posing threats to other countries. So how do you view that? What's your reaction?
I would say that from the product life cycle theory, that at the beginning, there are not enough supply of those products. So we are still in that stage. So in this regard, I think that the first priority for all the countries trying to address our, you know, commitments to the climate change. And, you know, when we are talking about that, we still need more market to encourage the innovation. China is one of the countries leading this area, and we are still trying to provide the world with affordable products and services and even solutions. So without this cooperation, I don't think it will be enough. But we still admit that we can try to cooperate with many other countries in trying to with a better, more adaptable changes on the different solutions. And that is also providing so many opportunities to the stakeholders from other countries. I believe that is also one of our, you know, the intention to in the trade and investment region.
That's Zhou Mi, Senior Research Fellow with the Chinese Academy of International Trade and Economic Cooperation, speaking with my colleague Zhao Yang. Israel said on Sunday that it was reducing its number of soldiers from southern Gaza, leaving only one brigade in the area. A spokesperson of Israel Defense Forces said the move was another stage in the war effort, stressing a significant force would remain in Gaza. Both Israel and Hamas have sent delegations to Cairo to join fresh ceasefire negotiations. Sunday marked 6 months of the war between Israel and Hamas. Tens of thousands of Israelis rallied against their Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu over the weekend, demanding a deal to release the hostages held in Gaza. Joining us now in the studio is my colleague Ding Heng. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Zhaoying.
So, why do you think Israel's pullout is widely seen as tactical rather than a sign that the war is moving closer to an end?
Because we can clearly judge this from the Israeli Defense Forces spokesperson, who said that the war can only be over when the Israeli hostages come home and when Hamas is gone. We have also heard from this Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant that the troops were leaving to prepare for their follow-up mission. These are some of the basic facts. Regarding the southern Gaza pullout, we're mostly talking about a city over there called Khan Yunis. It has been under Israeli bombardment for almost 4 months, close to 4 months up till now. And the city and its surrounding areas have been largely destroyed by the Israelis. And according to Israel, it has dismantled the local brigades of the Hamas and killed thousands of its members. So according to Israel, there is no need to remain militarily in Khan Yunis. But in the meantime, Israel has also, you know, long warned about a planned ground offensive in Rafah, which is another southern spot in Gaza where more than 1 million, actually more than 1.5 million, according to the latest figures I have read about, displaced Palestinians are sheltering over there. At the moment, it does not really look like that particular plan of attacking the Rafah has been shelved by the Israeli side. And I think a self-lining might be those displaced Palestinians from Khan Yunis may now be able to return to their homes.
Yes, and according to Egyptian reports, the latest round of negotiations in Cairo has made progress, with all parties having agreed on basic points. For example, negotiators have reportedly talked about around 40 Israeli hostages going free in the first stage of a prospective deal. So what do you make of the progress here, and how optimistic should we be about a ceasefire deal?
I think there is a sense of cautious optimism over there. Hamas captured 253 people during its October the 7th attack. Then at the end of last November, there was a week-long ceasefire in which 100 hostages were released in exchange for some more than 200 Palestinian women and children, I guess, held in Israeli jails. But since then, rounds of negotiations aimed at a second and longer ceasefire had not really been going too well. And currently, there were still, I think, close to 130 remaining Israeli hostages. So if there could be a deal for the releasing of 40 hostages, that would be quite something. But in the meantime, we also need to keep in mind that those very sticky points for negotiations are still there. For example, the Hamas has shown no signs regarding, say, giving up its demands like a permanent ceasefire, the withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza, a return of the displaced Palestinians to their homes, and a serious exchange deal of the Israeli hostages for Palestinian prisoners, etc. And in the meantime, on the part of the Israeli side, it does not seem to be, you know, wavering. This kind of determination to continue the war is still there, and really to try to eradicate Hamas over there in Gaza. So overall, the situation remains to be very uncertain.
Okay, and last week, U.S. President Joe Biden told Benjamin Netanyahu that future U.S. policy towards Israel will be determined by whether its government takes action to protect aid workers and civilians in Gaza. Of course, we know Biden's warning was a response to the recent killing of 7 international aid workers, including a U.S. citizen, by Israel. But how credible do you think this U.S. rhetoric on policy change towards Israel could be?
I think we need to make judgment by observing what the United States will really do next rather than its rhetoric. I think there is no doubt that Biden has had a long-standing, even unconditional support for Israel. Some people even say since October the 7th, President Biden has afforded Israel the kind of support exceeded perhaps only by former U.S. President Richard Nixon's during the 1973 Arab-Israeli War. And regarding this kind of recent killing of 7 international aid workers, actually one thing undeniable is that on the same day of that very deadly Israeli strike, the Biden administration actually approved the transfer of thousands of bombs to Israel, and it is currently weighing an $18 billion U.S. dollar arms sale to Israel that would include fighter jets and other equipment. In general, on the war in Gaza, I would say there is really a disconnection or out of touch with the reality in terms of the ultimate decision made by the Biden administration. The mounting international pressure and the concerns domestically voiced by the Arab Americans and some progressive Democrats have been widely reported in media. But even within the White House, there is a perceivable disagreement. According to a former director of the U.S. State Department's Office for Security and Human Rights, the current mood among State Department staff is even worse compared to during the U.S. invasion of Iraq back in 2003. And apart from 2 public resignations from the State Department that were linked to the war, more people are in a private manner expressing their concern. There have been at least 7 internal dissent memos regarding Biden's Gaza policy.
Yeah, and prior to the outbreak of the war on October 7th, Israel's domestic politics largely featured deep divisions. And some people say with the current protests in Israel, the country's political division is once again on public display. What is your take on this?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty fair assessment, because if elections were held in Israel today, most opinions polls would suggest that Netanyahu will be unable to form a government. Many Israelis actually hold Netanyahu responsible for the security flaws that allowed the October 7th attack to occur in the first place. However, I think on the part of Netanyahu himself, he has never openly admitted any responsibility for that. That really infuriates many people who have joined the ongoing protests. And in the meantime, no doubt, Netanyahu has been a consistent opponent of a two-state solution, and his critics say his stubborn rejection of Joe Biden's plan for a post-war governance of Gaza is really a political tool for him to secure the kind of continued support from Israel's extreme right wing. But in the meantime, I think Israelis would generally support this idea of destroying Hamas. So one explanation of Netanyahu's determination to continue this war is largely he is seeking or he is aiming at his own political survival domestically. Because if he is removed from office one day, then don't forget those ongoing investigations about his alleged crime. Alleged corruption, rather, etc., etc. So internal political survival is very key to himself, That's for sure.
Yeah, thank you, Dingheng. Thanks for joining us today. And you're listening to World Today. We'll be back. This is World Today. I'm Zhao Ying. Mexico has cut diplomatic ties with Ecuador after police stormed the Mexican embassy in Quito to arrest former Ecuadorian Vice President Jorge Glass. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador says the move was a flagrant violation of international law. Glass took refuge in the embassy in December after Ecuador issued an arrest warrant against him for alleged corruption. Glass's lawyer said he was innocent. For more, we are joined by Dr. Tim Anderson, director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, a Sydney-based think tank. Dr. Anderson, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
So can you provide some context on the recent events leading to Mexico's decision to cut diplomatic ties with Ecuador, particularly on the arrest of former Ecuadorian Vice President Jorge Glass at the Mexican embassy?
Yes, well, to begin with, Jorge Glass was a vice president under President Rafael Correa and then President Lenin Moreno, who was in Correa's party, but then turned around and abandoned that party, basically. And under Lenin Moreno, Jorge Glass was charged with one count of corruption. And since then, Moreno's successors, Guillermo Lasso and Daniel Noboa, the current president, there were additional corruption charges laid against them, but they're seen very widely in Latin America as politicized cases to try and keep Glass out of Ecuadorian politics. So he was in jail for some time, and then he completed a large part of the initial sentence, and he was released on a type of parole, during which time he approached the Mexican embassy and eventually asked for political asylum there. And the recent event is that the Ecuadorian government or the Ecuadorian police, on the orders of the government, breached the Mexican embassy, brutalized the Mexican ambassador, and rearrested Glass and took him back to a maximum security jail. Now, that's what's caused Mexico to cut relations with Ecuador and, in fact, launch a case at the International Court of Justice against Ecuador for violating the sanctity of the Mexican embassy in Quito.
Okay. Can you explain the significance of diplomatic immunity and why does Mexico believe Ecuador's actions violated international law regarding embassies?
So there are conventions, Vienna conventions, on the status of embassies, and they're enforced, you know, notionally through the United Nations. The UN Secretary General has reinforced this just recently, that those embassies, and this issue came up, of course, when the Israelis attacked the Iranian embassy in Damascus too, just recently, and killed a number of Iranian officials. So the inviolability of embassies is a strong principle of international law. So that's why the Mexicans are getting a lot of support from other states, some other Latin American states, for example. Either Nicaragua has cut relations with Ecuador as a result of it. Some other Latin American states, even European states, are expressing concern about this because it's a very clear and long-standing rule that they can't simply charge into embassies and arrest people in the way that the Ecuadorian government just did.
Okay. And as you mentioned, Mexico granted political asylum to Jorge Glass after Ecuador issued an arrest warrant against him. But did Mexico have a strong case there? And why is it perceived by Ecuador as a violation of its laws?
Well, there's also a convention about diplomatic asylum when it's thought that in particular people are being persecuted politically. And I think Mexico took that view of the ongoing imprisonment of Jorge Glass and the series of charges laid against him, which in Latin America are often now referred to as lawfare. That is to say, there's a type of political persecution going on, which was spoken of in relation to former President Rafael Correa, for example, also in relation to former presidents Lula da Silva in Brazil and Dilma Rousseff. There's been a series of these sorts of actions. So Mexico and a number of other states see the case against Glass as being essentially a political case. There was one thing that happened before the recent arrest, and that was that the Mexican government also expressed doubts about the election of the recent election last year of the interim president Daniel Noboa. At the moment, he was actually elected in an election last year where there was a vacancy as a result of effectively the dissolution of the National Assembly and the forced resignation of the former president, Guillermo Lasso. So I believe the Mexican president said that there was doubt because of the assassination of one of the candidates for that election last year, and also an increased spiral of violence in the country. Well, the current Ecuadorian government took exception to that and expelled the Mexican ambassador, the previous Mexican ambassador, the Quito. So the current Mexican ambassador is one that was recently replaced after that incident.
Okay, but very briefly, what role do you see international organizations playing in mediating this situation?
Well, the UN Secretary General has made a statement about it, but it was not a very strong statement. It's not as strong as the one that was made after the Israeli attack on the Iranian embassy, but it's of a similar character in terms of the international conventions that it violates. So there's been concern expressed by a number of different states, particularly Latin American states, Central American states, Cuba, Nicaragua, and I believe Germany has expressed some concern too. Now there is this case in the International Court of Justice, and that may attract more attention because many states, of course, have a worry that this might be creating a precedent, that the Israelis are bombing an embassy in Damascus. If the Ecuadorians are going into an embassy in Quito, what does it mean for their their diplomatic institutions?
Yes. So I think thank you, Dr. Tim Manderson, Director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, a Sydney-based think tank. That's all the time we have for this edition of World Today. I'm Zhao Ying. Thanks for listening. See you next time.